This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Classically trained pianist Paul Schwartzel fondly remembers the first piece of sheet music he purchased with his own money. Was it Bach? Was it Beethoven? It was this. Well, if you know the 80s music, then you know that's the keyboard-heavy intro to Girl, You Know It's True by Milli Vanilli. Paul considers himself an aficionado of 80s music, despite the fact that he was born only 2 years into the decade. But he didn't quite know what to do with his appreciation for the 80s, particularly as he continued on the path to becoming a serious composer. After all, can the decade that produced Milli Vanilli be taken seriously? Yes, Paul thinks so. And in fact, he has channeled his love of the 80s pop, rock, hip-hop, and contemporary classical into academic study. In addition to being a graduate student in the Department of Music at Duke University, Paul Schwartzel is an instructor of a freshman writing course called I Love the 80s. He's with us today to tell us more about that class and his relationship to music. Paul, welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Hi, good to be here.
Let me ask you straight out, why is the music of the 1980s worthy of academic study?
Well, it's a misunderstood decade, I believe. For one thing, people tend to think, when you say the 80s, people think, the movies like The Breakfast Club, Michael Jackson. But there's so many other things going on. It's you don't have like a lot of the music without the 90s without the developments occurring in the 80s. And we study that. And at the same time, I wanted to teach a course that taught not only the popular music of the decade, but also the contemporary classical music of the decade, which I think is fascinating. It's wonderful.
And I guess the rap on, you'll pardon the expression, on the 80s is that it was a kind of a gloss, that it just never got serious, that in terms of performance, it was fabulous. Superstars did emerge, but it just never seemed to be about much. Is that a critique that you take on in the class?
Well, the course has, well, we do address some of the, I guess we address a lot of the mainstream music, of course, but we also address music that was not on the mainstream. A lot of the readings that we do are not on the mainstream. Most of the readings we do are not from the mainstream point of view. And the point is to be very critical about the decade, but also at the same time, have an appreciation for it.
Well, now, you're a composer as well,
yeah.
And you talk about the music that was going on in that vein. It's not classical music, because that's a particular period in time and space, but it was music that was not necessarily popular music. Were they affected? Are they influenced? Is that kind of music and are those compositions of the 80s influenced by the popular culture of the 80s?
There were some composers, one composer I can think of, like Michael Torkey, who was interested in pop music and would write music. I'm thinking of like a piece like the Yellow Pages that was using a classical ensembles, or he was writing orchestral music, which was inspired by popular music, chordal progressions, and it's very fascinating music. You
know? Well, Michael Torkey, Yellow Pages, here it is. Let's listen to a little bit of that right now. So that's not Milli Vanilli.
Not Milli Vanilli.
Would you say that was part? Were there changes? What kinds of actual changes in terms of the way music? Because, you know, if we think about the 60s, which us geezers keep coming back to as though it was the only decade in the world, there was a kind of a real change in what was happening in popular music. It was going from a jazz kind of dance music to a very different form of music. Did that happen? Was that kind of abrupt change in the 80s, a sea change in music?
Well, there are many changes going on in various genres. I mean, there's the common view is, you know, they think of new wave music, that was in like the Breakfast Club movies, Breakfast Club movie, and Michael Jackson, Prince, Madonna. But there's so much going on. There's bands like Sonic Youth that are writing wonderful music. There's bands like Fugazi. There are bands like Jane's Addiction.
Well, that piece that we just heard, Yellow Pages.
Yeah.
Was there anything in that that I might have heard on the radio? Any influence in what we just heard?
Michael Torkey has written pieces before, I believe, in which one of his pieces he's actually used the bass line from a Chaka Khan song as an ostinato, repeating bass line. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, he's using chord progressions that you hear in popular music.
And if we're talking about the 1980s, of course, we have to talk about the big three in
Triumvirate.
The 1980s, right? There they are, Prince, Madonna, and, of course, Michael Jackson. She was more like a beauty queen from a movie scene. I said, don't mind, but what do you mean? I am the one that could dance on the floor and around. She said, I am the one who would dance on the floor and around. Hey, there's Michael Jackson, Billie Jean, and you think of that song, and of course, you know, immediately memories of the birth of MTV come to mind, the early days of MTV. Do you talk about the impact of MTV on the industry in your class?
Yes. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the birth of MTV with Michael Jackson, because he was not originally played on MTV until maybe, I'd say, a year and a half until afterwards. Keep this in mind. I believe of the 750 music videos that they showed in the first few years of MTV, only 24 featured black musicians. This is, I believe, Rick James referred it to as white rock TV.
And so what do you think accounts for the change in the – because that is a memory. I mean, it's fascinating that when you think back to MTV, Michael Jackson is one of the figures who really comes to mind. As the guy who put his stamp on music video.
Well, once Michael Jackson started making the videos on Thriller, it was – everything had to be judged against that. Everything was – you could do mediocre things, but they just weren't going to compare to that level of sophistication with like the choreography, the high production values, getting, you know, Jonathan Landis on board. So
your classroom is filled with kids who were born, I guess, in the 90s.
Yep.
So how do they relate to the 80s?
Well, that was the thing. The very first class that we had, the first question I asked was, what music do you listen to and what music do your parents listen to? And it was surprising that a lot of the students mentioned that there was overlap between the music they listened to and the parents listened to, and a lot of that was 80s music. So,
well, you were talking about videos, too. The video for Madonna's Like a Prayer was controversial for being a provocative portrayal of spiritual worship. Let's listen to some of that. It's like a dream, no end and no beginning. You're here with me. It's like Like a Prayer, Madonna, that video and her career in general and a lot of the statements that she's made about her aspirations point to her when she's been criticized for, particularly among black academics, for appropriating black culture. And that's something you deal with squarely in your class.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely. I made them read an article by Bell Hooks. And what I wanted them to think about was, I mean, shows like Glee have had episodes that celebrate Madonna. And what I wanted to do was then to at least think about and to hear different points of view that some ways just didn't celebrate her, say that, you know, she was not breaking with any of the patriarchal status, but she was, you know, endorsing and perpetuating it.
Yeah, and that has always been, for the most popular performers, isn't that the critique? It's the critique in hip-hop as well. Are you reinforcing this culture, or is it a satire or a pushback against it? And to what extent does your reflection of this system, if it's oppressive, how much does that in fact validate the system? And that's a question certainly that applied to Madonna.
Well, Madonna is interesting. She, when she makes this Like a Prayer video, she's criticizing her Catholic upbringing, but yet she's using black actors and actresses to they're essentially in there for supporting roles. I mean, their only job there is to catch her when she's an angel falling. I just wanted them to think about the images of how of black representation. And at the time that of the video, the outrage was not over the use of how blacks were represented. It was just about the religious outcry.
Right, right. In that particular one. But she has been criticized, and Bell Hooks in her essay does criticize Madonna for her aspiration and her overt appreciation, where she says she appreciates African-American culture. She'd like to imitate it. She wishes she was black. All of those things, that kind of envy, which Bell Hooks says, like all envy, can be destructive of the very thing that it desires. And that's a point that she makes in this. But that's the point of pop culture, isn't it? That's what happens. And the best pop culture artists are those in those liminal spaces that are both transgression and the reflection of popular culture, isn't that? And part of, I think, what you're probably getting at in the 1980s.
Yes, I completely agree. I'm actually curious. What music from the 80s did you listen to?
Oh, I didn't listen to any of it.
Really?
No, I was busy. That was my roots period. So by the mid 1970s, when the raunchiest part of rock and roll and the blues stuff had all died, and it started to get pretty glossy, you know, I started to go back into roots, and that's when I began to listen to classical music, roots blues music, listen to jazz, all the standards that I'd missed, because the stuff that was happening on the radio just didn't appeal to me at all. So I bowed out of that. And if it hadn't been for Lindsay Foster Thomas, our managing editor, who loves the 80s, I would know nothing about it. But I know now, and it's a fascinating period, and becoming more interesting to me, because there are these, you know, the very popular currents that are on the radio, and then there's all the stuff that, as you say, was kind of a little off the radar. To what extent did it reflect, and again, this is my only touchstone, would be the 60s, when a lot of the music was garbage, and a lot of the music that was played on the radio was garbage, and about nothing. But some of it was about stuff, and it was about what was going on. To what extent did the 80s try to reflect directly the political changes happening in the 80s?
Well, an interesting trend about the time, the decade, is that there's essentially a buildup of tension within. You start out with this, you know, dance pop, synth pop music from the 80s and new wave. And by the time you reach 1989, there's a lot of frustration in music. You have NWA, you have Guns N' Roses, you have musical groups that are very angry. And they're dealing with a lot of frustrations after a decade of harsh conservative rule. So
you go beyond pop music too. You talked about that. You deal with the birth and the rise of hip-hop music, which I guess in some ways, in terms of popular music, might begin with the Sugar Hill Gang. Let's listen.
I said a hip hop, the hip it, the hip it, the hip hip hop. You don't stop the rocker to the bang bang boogie. Say up jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie to beat. Now what you hear is not a test. I'm rapping to
police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad cause I'm brown. And not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority.
There we go, from the Sugar Hill Gang to NWA, and there's quite So what about that? What does that evolution tell us about what was going on in the 80s?
Well, when I look at hip-hop history, I think about you know, social changes, of course, but I also think about technological changes. When you're listening to Rapper's Delight at the beginning, that was recorded on one take, and it featured live musicians. And I mean, they basically told the bass player, you know, you got the people are going to be talking really fast over it. He didn't really know what to expect. And which is amazing to me. If you had never heard rap before and were not prepared for the internal rhymes of that song, I mean, I trying to keep up like for 15 minutes playing the same thing is, you know, is pretty impressive.
Yeah. And you also talk about the fact in your class, I know, that grunge, which we associate mostly with the 90s, you know, it's really something that had its roots in the 80s. And you can't, you know, you sort of just don't wake up Kurt Cobain and say, oh, let's make Nirvana happen out of
no air. It's not like in The Wrestler where Mickey Rourke says Marissa Tomei are saying 80s best decade ever, and then that, you know, Cobain guy had to come around and ruin it all. Yeah, it didn't happen just like that, right. You know, but there was developments going on in Seattle in the mid 80s, and that's actually what my students are looking at right now.
And what about on the other side, when we look at what we're going to call serious music compositions, the kind of stuff that you teach, what was happening during that decade?
Well, post-minimalism was rising. There's so many things going on. If you look at the book on orchestration by Samuel Adler, he mentions in the 1979 book, he makes prophecies about what's going to happen in the 80s. And then in the 1994 edition of the book, he says, well, that's not exactly what happened. I thought there was going to be all this crazy music. There was going to be the most sophisticated extended techniques for performers. And that's not really what happened. In some forms of composition schools, there was a return to more simplicity, I guess, or a more diatonic language. It wasn't so chromatic and dense and traditionally dissonant. There was a return to more of an acceptance for, more triadic-based harmony.
Yeah, maybe it is the decade of unfulfilled promise. You know, you asked me my preferences, and then in the 80s, with the birth of MTV, I looked and said, this could transform video, movies, TV, the way we see the world. Narrative itself could change by the insistent change that we see on MTV. I think I was the only guy in my neighborhood who had black and white TV, but actually paid the $2 a month to my cable company to get MTV in stereo, because I was so interested in what might happen as a result of this new genre. And man, it didn't happen.
Well, what's amazing about MTV is that when you had groups like the Parents Music Resource Center criticizing music, saying this shouldn't be banned, this should be banned, this is appropriate, this is not appropriate, they weren't criticizing the music half the time. They were criticizing the music videos, but they wanted to put a ban on the music, the actual album sales. And they were upset with the images of the actual video and not the content of the actual music.
Great stuff. What do you want your students to take away from this class?
I want them, well, it's a writing course, and I want them to be able to think critically about music. I mean, put it this way. In the same way that people should think about what they eat and where they get it from, think about the music that you listen to and where you get it from.
Paul, thanks so much for being in the program.
It's been great.
Paul Schwartzel, composer and graduate student in the Department of Music at Duke, and he is an instructor of freshman writing course at Duke called I Love the 80s. Coming up, Tiny Tim grows up and Scrooge is dead, but the story of A Christmas Carol continues in a musical by former Mad Magazine editor Nick Meglin. Stay with us on The State of Things.